This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Coming up at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Galavan interviews abstract painter Diane Avio-Agi, whose show Synergy is on now at the Mark Woolley Gallery. Stay tuned for Stage and Studio with host Dime Roberts. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588. Or cstpdx.com.
Stage and Studio. We're listening to Daryl Grant's music piece. It's called Golden West. It's one of the movements in Grant's new 9-part composition called The Territory. It's debuting at Chamber Music Northwest, and we'll be talking with the longtime Portland composer and pianist about how he focused on Pacific Northwest geography and history as an inspiration for his work. And in the latter part of the show, we'll hear a feature story on what makes Woodburn the most diverse town in Oregon. So stay with us. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dime Roberts. With me in the studio is performer, composer, and Portland State University professor Daryl Grant. Welcome to Stage and Studio.
Thanks very much, Dime.
I've heard your music and heard about you for years, and it's just a pleasure to meet you. You're a long-timer.
I guess it's getting to be that way now, isn't it?
As a jazz pianist and composer, you've performed at venues like Carnegie Hall and the San Francisco Jazz Festivals, and you've been a guest on Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz. That's an iconic show, isn't it? And toured internationally with many jazz legends. And you've chosen really historic and significant themes for your work. And I'm very impressed with especially the Truth and Reconciliation Project that you did. Was it 2007 that you did that? And that focused on South Africa's struggle to end apartheid. And you dedicated an album to ending apartheid. And it's a huge endeavor. Do you want to describe what the project was, what it meant to you personally?
I've always felt like music, I've been a musician since I was 7 years old, but I've always felt like music was a means to something bigger than music. And so I felt like I've always wanted to use the music that I did to try and make connections to, bring awareness to, and for myself to learn about different things. So I think it may have been about 2005 when I went to a lecture sponsored by the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. And it was this Bishop Peter Story, who was a bishop from South Africa. And he was talking about the Truth and Reconciliation process. And this album had been sort of incubating in me for a while, but I didn't really have a point. I didn't have a thing I wanted. And when I heard that story, I thought, that's it. That's the connection I was looking for, that will sort of draw this music together and give me some impetus to write and find a narrative or a storyline behind the album. And so that the idea of truth and reconciliation, the idea of finding one's own truth. And for me personally, it was kind of reconciling all the different musical and, parts of myself into one kind of cohesive whole. And I just felt like that really resonated with me.
And it was a very successful album, too.
Well, as far as jazz albums go, yes.
Yeah. I mean, the Truth and Reconciliation album, and it was selected one of the top 10 jazz CDs of 2007.
So well, that's true.
Pretty successful. I would actually like to play a section of that. And okay. Begins actually a song called When I See the Water.
Oh, yeah.
And it begins with an excerpt of the great Nelson Mandela, and he's giving a speech.
Yeah, I actually wrote that song or started writing that song when he came to New York. I was living in New York when he'd sort of been freed from prison and was doing his sort of World War tour, and was just so amazed. I mean, the outpouring of love and respect for him and hope, I think, at that time was something we hadn't seen up to that point. So that was in my apartment in Brooklyn and wrote the beginnings of that song.
Wow. I love the personal connection to it. Let's hear it. It begins with Nelson Mandela.
I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an idea for which I hope to live for. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
Like a river through the plains, winding through the heat in search of a rain. Knowing I will someday see the sea, shackled though I seem, my soul is free. The things they told me not to say, beaten, but I'll go on anyway. Calling out the truth for all to hear. People, time to put away your fear.
Well, we send our love and thoughts to Mr. Mandela at this time and to South Africa. It was very moving to hear his voice and then hear your singing voice together and the lyrics. How often do you sing on your albums?
I've started doing it more and more.
Lovely voice.
Thank you. My mother was a singer, so I sort of spent most of my life intimidated by the possibility of doing it. And that was another thing about, you know, this record and the record before it, Spirit, where I really felt like, you know, we have our thing to do on this planet, and whether it is the thing we're best at or whether, you know, something we're going to grow into, we have to do what we're called to do. And so there were songs there that needed to be sung, and it seemed like I was the person in place to do them, so I just did the best I could.
You had a calling.
Yeah. Yeah.
You had a calling to do this album, right?
Yeah.
Well, do you feel that with a lot of your work?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't want to make it sound more grandiose, but you know,
motivated? Is that your inspiration?
I am. I guess, I mean, my parents sort of always, you know, I was a child of the civil rights era, right? So, you know, when I was a little boy, you know, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and, I mean, you know, all these wonderful James Farmer and Jesse Jackson Jr. and all these leaders were being bold and sort of, and my parents sort of raised me to believe that that was a legacy that I was inheriting, and there was no way that I could sleep on it. I owed them too much to just, you know, coast. So I guess I'm always trying to think of, you know, how can I add something to that legacy of accomplishment. Those great people. Nelson Mandela is, you know, perfect example. I mean, I could aspire to only shine his shoes and live the best life I could. You know, he's such an incredible spirit.
Well, I love how you're adding to the conversation. You know, you're adding to the history and sort of building on that and keeping it alive, too, you know? Thanks. You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. My guest is Portland jazz pianist and composer Daryl Grant and singer. He's soon debuting a new nine-part composition. It's called The Territory at Chamber Music Northwest on July 6th and 7th. On your blog, you talk about the Oregon myth. The mythology that we carry with the journey to Oregon. What is your Oregon myth?
Well, it's funny, you know, I was, it's been really a blast preparing this, you know, working on this piece over the course of a year, because I really wanted to sort of look for inspiration and connection, because I felt when I came to Oregon, I just felt, oh, this is really distinctive place with distinctive ways of being and thinking. I mean, and they really are reflected. I mean, I think the way that we use land, the way that we sort of organize people, the way that, I mean, there is something here. I'm not an environmental historian like my friend Bill Lang, Professor Bill Lang at PSU, who could actually sort of tell you the policies that really went into making that. And so we have these really fascinating discussions about how much of this, you know, Oregon or Portland thing that everybody is trying to get, everybody's moving here to get, is real, and how much of it is sort of manufactured hype. And I think, you know, I think we live on myth. I mean, human beings are story-making creatures. I mean, we are always trying to find reason in stories for things, put stories to things. And so I don't think that there's anything wrong with the fact that we have myth. I think it's really about what we do with it. So, you know, people have always asked me, why did you move to Oregon? Why did you move from New York City? You know, and so the thing I remember is that when I was like 11 years old, I came to Oregon on a state choir, on a church choir tour. And I remember, you know, in my mind, I can see driving north. I can see this green, like lushness. And I don't honestly know. Like, when I start to think about that, I go, why was I in Oregon on a church choir tour at 11? Would my parents have really let me do that? I could go up, I could look it up. I could see if we did, you know, but the picture in my mind is what brought me here. Is that's why I wanted to move here. So it may be a myth, it may be true, but I've tried to sort of build on that and to create something out of that. And I feel like that's true for, you know, all the myths that we bring to Oregon, this wonderful place.
I think of myth as, you know, sacred stories, or just stories that are larger than us, but also based in reality and truth. And and so when I think about some of the historic themes that and the geographical themes of the territory that you have put together here, I mean, to me, you know, their myth, their history, you know, all mixed together, right, too. So I just want to go through the nine parts of the composition.
Sure.
You know, we can't do everything, but just so that people get a sense of the landscape that you are creating with this really amazing composition
I'm looking
forward to, you know, to hearing. The Surrender of the Nez Perce with excerpts of Chief Joseph's famous speech,
yeah.
You know?
You know, it's funny. I realized that when I was looking for, you know, stories to sort of resonate with this piece, and one of them obviously is the native peoples on the land, and Chief Joseph is this, you know, iconic figure. And again, my conversations with Bill Lang, the historian, who's sort of telling me, well, you know, a lot of that is myth. A lot of that was created by the sort of establishment at the time, the government at the time, which was trying to heroize and lionize any Native American that surrendered.
Yeah.
You know, so when you think about what Joseph is famous for, he's famous for a retreat and he's famous for being not a warrior, not a general. He's famous for
which is
like,
the opposite
running,
of what he
right?
was.
But
yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, historians are really the ones who sort of look at the facts and go, you know, he wasn't a great general. And that's pretty much agreed upon. And the fact that he was betrayed, that's pretty much agreed upon. But, you know, so I think that's so anyway, that sort of, as you dig up more and more of that myth, it comes. But I, you know, the idea of this man who, you know, didn't want to leave his land and was sort of forced off his land to die off his land, that to me seemed like something, a part of the tale that needed to be told. And I actually started off using some of the surrender speech, but I actually took that that part out of the piece. And what I wound up using was this speech that he, this saying that he said, what his father told him about never sell, you know, never sell the bones of your father. And that's what really resonated with me. It's like, never sell the bones of your father and your mother. And he was true to that, you know.
Beautiful. And, beautiful. I get shivers thinking about that concept right there. And then Minidoka internment camp that housed people who were forced in concentration camp conditions in Idaho. Of course, this history is something that needs to be remembered. There's also another camp on the Oregon border or close to it, Tule Lake, too.
Right,
so
right.
It's very close to us
it is,
in Oregon.
And there, the thing is, I mean, you learn about these things as part of World War II. I don't know if I would have learned about it if I hadn't lived in, you know, the Pacific Northwest, but a really wonderful singer and friend of mine, Nola Bogle, who, you know, when she was four, she went on the train to Minidoka. She was intern there.
Yeah.
So she remembers these. And I just thought, you know, how amazing to actually have someone who's part of that story. And so I wanted to, you know, include that as, you know, that's one of the pieces of the territory.
And another bit of history there is so much depth to this composition that you're creating with the territory. Chinese gold miners who were massacred in the Hell's Canyon in 1887.
Yeah.
How do you get inspiration from that? I mean, it was obviously a hate crime of the time.
Well,
you know?
It's true, but you know, this was again another conversation that I had with Bill Lang about, you know, well, so, you know, we try and celebrate the positive myth of Oregon, this wonderful, you know, what he calls, just sort of our exceptionalism, Oregon exceptionalism, right? But we're in conflict because that exceptionalism goes directly up against some of the facts, it's almost like it's this sort of double-edged sword that we can believe that we're special and that makes us, that gives us the power to do certain things. How do we use that power? So this, you know, this particular tragedy, I just wanted to sort of imagine what's left on the land from an event like that. Like, how does, you know, what's the sort of what resonates? And so that this little piece was called The Aftermath, which is sort of, you know, how you would feel if you, you know, the day after that Hell's Canyon massacre. What does the land feel like? What are the vibrations in the air? And, you know, so I'm just going to imagine
the legacy of that. Well, and then this is not necessarily as sad as the other stories that, you know, of the moments of history, but the Sundays at the Golden West. We heard the theme earlier at the beginning of the show. And the Golden West Hotel is the second largest African-American hotel west of the Mississippi.
Yeah.
Where's the Golden West now? Where is it located?
The Golden West now. It's on the corner, I feel like, Everett and Broadway. Everett and Broadway. Yeah. The building's still there.
It had so many jazz greats who came through and performed there. And
yeah.
You know,
well, not perform there, but also stay there. I mean, there's a recording,
right.
I think, of... can't remember the genre. Freddie Keppard's band from like the 1920s, you know. So this is like the earliest days of jazz. And so I'm thinking, wow, this was actually happening. But the fact that this was the only place where African Americans could stay. So whether they were Pullman porters or, you know, celebrity musicians and actors, this was the place that they had to stay in Portland. And I just kind of, I love the idea that there's this place that's the central communication hub and mixing point for this community. And it's right there. It's still right there.
You did so much research on this. Really,
well, I am
did.
A college professor. That's
no,
my, kind of my gig.
It comes with the territory, right? Literally.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I think that it's so informed, and the music has to be informed as well, you know, based on the stories that you're telling, you know? Yeah, I'm just really excited about that. And then you also throw in there, I don't want to throw in there, but incorporate in there things like the new land, the final movement. It focuses on this powerful vibe, which you were talking about, sort of the Oregon story, but the vibe of the Pacific Northwest itself.
Mm-hmm.
What is the vibe? You know, that's a horrible question, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that's almost impossible to answer. But this last piece, this last section of the piece, New Land, was really, to me, when I think about who are the most, like, you know, when people came to, you know, along the Oregon Trail you know, and they landed or they, you know, Oregon City or whatever. I can imagine some of them kissing the ground, right? I can imagine them just like, you know, we are here. This
because
is
of
it.
The journey.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was sort of wondering who that happens to now. I was thinking about, it's funny, you're talking about Woodburn, you know, in your show about it being diverse. And so I imagine that, you know, people, when I think of migrant people
or immigrants
that want to, that are coming here to actually start a new life. And I mean, they have reason to be optimistic. You know, it's like it's just this myth continues to regenerate. And it's almost like this opportunity to create, to build something new. And the land is still here. The land is still that sort of green, verdant, fertile, welcoming place that inspires dreams. And so that's sort of what made me titled this the last movement, New Land.
Beautiful. Daryl Grant's debut of The Territory is part of Chamber Music Northwest Concert. It's titled A Sense of Place. This performs for only two shows, and it's 8 p.m. on July 6th at Reed College and 4 p.m. July 7th at St. Mary's Academy, and they're both in Portland. For more info or tickets, visit Chamber Music Northwest sites. It's cmnw.org. You can also visit Daryl Grant's website, darylgrant.com, and I'll have all those links at stageandstudio.org. And it's just been so great to talk with you.
Oh, thanks
and
for asking me.
And kudos on you know, and congratulations on this new work.
Oh, thanks. I can't wait to hear it myself.
Hopefully you'll record it, though, right? You'll have
a CD
of
so
it.
Too. Yeah, and, very much so.
Are you already thinking of your next project?
Nope. Not yet.
This is a major accomplishment, so
thanks.
Kudos to you. It's been a pleasure visiting with you and hearing about your work.
Thanks.
Up next, I recently went to Woodburn for the Latino USA radio program to look at the growing diversity in the town. In Oregon, Latinos have worked on farms since 1942, when an agreement between the U.S. and Mexico brought thousands of farm workers through the Bracero Guest Worker Program. But in the last couple of decades, many workers have settled in Oregon, and Woodburn is in the rich farmland of the Mid-Willamette Valley. It's now up to 60% Latino.
Luis Quintero of Luis's Taqueria runs a popular restaurant on Main Street. His is one of many businesses with Spanish language signs in downtown Woodburn. Quintero and his wife, former farm workers, started their business 20 years ago and felt welcome enough to bring family members from Mexico to this small town.
Since we moved up here, we brought 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 families. Because I saw the potential. We saw a better results than just working for somebody else. A lot of opportunities here in Oregon. We just need to look for it. Just do your work, do your part, and leave the rest for somebody else.
Woodburn has a long history of live and let live. For generations, it's been a haven for outsiders, like the Russian Orthodox community called the Old Believers. It's also known for its drag strip, the largest outlet mall in Oregon, and a yearly tulip festival that draws tourists. And though a town of only 24,000 people, Woodburn is now home to the largest population of Latinos in the state. Nearly 60% of Woodburn's full-time residents are Latino, according to the 2010 census. And that's a big change since City Council President Pete McCallum moved to Woodburn 47 years ago.
Woodburn was a small, sleepy community, had about 3,000-4,000 people. We used to joke that we always had to go somewhere else to get services, whether it be grocery or to eat. And maybe we had 12 students that were Latino in the graduating class. Now the schools number well over 70%.
Woodburn is a snapshot of what America is likely to be in 2050. And I can tell you, if that is so, not only do you have nothing to be afraid of, we have a lot to look forward to.
Catherine Figley has been Woodburn's mayor for 11 years. Despite her optimistic view, she's weathered her fair share of town crises. A 2008 bank bombing that killed 2 police officers, and more recently, 3 Latino youths were convicted of setting fire to their school. Figley called it a prank gone bad that caused $6 million in damages. For Figley, the daily challenge of diversity is communication.
Communicating with younger people is a challenge, and you have people who are recent immigrants, and in some cases not documented immigrants, who speak a variety of languages and have a different sources of information, and just sometimes getting the word out to people can be a challenge.
For example, recently the town sent out notices that the town's drinking water tested unsafe, but wanted to make sure Latinos got the word, so they ran the notice on Spanish language stations. A lot of communication involves working with several Latino organizations that have helped farm workers who wanted to settle in Woodburn. In 1985, agricultural workers formed a union of tree planters and farm workers called PCUN, or PICUN. That union fostered several organizations to help farm workers. One is the Farm Worker Housing Development Corporation. Roberto Jimenez is the executive director.
Some of the worst housing is on-farm housing. They're unregistered labor camps, so the state doesn't have any oversight of them. There may be no running water or no heat. There may be families living in units that were just designed for seasonal workers and living there year-round with no access to kitchens. And they're very, very isolated.
The Nuevo Amanecer project is one of two apartment complexes on a 14-acre site being built by the corporation. The units will include 40 farmworker families with close to 150 children. 300 more families are on the waiting list for their next project.
Woodburn has long been known as a good place to live. It's going to be larger. There's going to be a larger population of Latinos and probably other immigrants moving into farm work. But there's also going to be a lot more education available and a lot more documented young Latinos with ambitions. I think that's going to be a positive thing for the local economy.
One young Latino with ambitions is Jaime Orondo. Orondo is the director of special projects for Capacis Leadership Institute. Its goal is to train the next leaders of Woodburn.
There's, you know, 500,000 people in Oregon that are Latinos in Woodburn. We're talking about 14, 15,000 folks. 60% of the population, and out of that, 40% is under the age of 18, the Latino community. So a super young community. They're all U.S. citizens, these kids under 18. It's a very young community.
Orendo says Capacis, which means capable, is banking on their young people to stick around once they go to college. So they're starting early classes and mentorship on civic issues. Part of that training involves figuring out how to make city government work for the Latino community. Laura Isiordia, the executive director of Capacis, remembers long nights of contentious city council meetings in the late 90s, when the first farm worker housing project was being developed, and the remarks of one council member in particular.
And he goes, "Just go home. Go back to your countries. You don't belong here." And I respond to him with tears. You know, we're here. We're not going anywhere. This is our land too. You know, tears come to me when I remember that time.
Isiordia says the same community that told her to go back home now shows support, especially recently when Capacis wanted to paint a mural to depict farmworker struggles. But Isiordia says the next steps are the school board and the city council.
The board doesn't have people of color. Woodburn doesn't have a representation in their council for people of color. When we talking about representation, we're talking about positions and power.
And one of the things Woodburn might be looking forward to is more Latino representation in the 2014 election, when six city council seats will be up for re-election.
And if you want to see photos or hear this show again, visit stageandstudio.org. That piece on Woodburn originally aired on Latino USA, and I do have a photo gallery up at stageandstudio.org. Before we go, veteran dancer and choreographer Linda Austin is performing Reach 30, a new version of her very first dance work. It's called An Atrocity Exhibition in Two Parts. It's for 1 weekend only, June 27th through the 30th, Thursday through Sunday at 8 p.m. at Performance Works Northwest. That's located at 4625 Southeast 67th Avenue in Portland. And for tickets, you can visit reach.com. brownpapertickets.com or at the door. And if you haven't seen Linda Austin's work before, it really is tremendous. So a shout out to Linda Austin. That's it for Stage and Studio. My thanks to engineer Janet Anderson. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on the facebook.com/stage, the letter and studio, or tweet me at stage, the letter and studio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts. We're going out with more of Daryl Grant's Golden West from his new work, The Territory.
Next, it's Art Focus with host Joseph Galavan. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Oregon College of Art and Crafts Studio School, offering classes and workshops for adults in book arts, ceramics, drawing and painting, fibers, metals, photography, and wood. www.ocac.edu/register.
Andy Warhol lifts a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol lifts a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
I'm Joseph Galavan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week, our guest is Diane Arvio-Augie, whose show Synergy is now on at the Mark Woolley Gallery in Pioneer Place Mall through July 14th. Arvio-Augie's work takes as its starting point the light of stars and travels deep into abstract territory with the spiral as its core detail. Welcome, Diane. It's lovely to have you here at KABU.
Thank you, Joseph.